Hi, Strong Women listeners. Sarah and I want to invite you to a very exciting book club that we're hosting this month. We will be studying C.S. Lewis's Abolition of Man, which might be one of the most underrated C.S. Lewis books. In the book, Lewis argues for the importance of universal values like courage and honor, values that are far too lacking in this current cultural landscape.
And if you don't already have this book or would like to read it again with us, the Colson Center is offering Abolition of Man plus Michael Ward's commentary on it for a donation of any amount. You will also receive 3 videos by Michael Ward that will guide you as you read. Use our special link to get this offer, breakpoint.org/SW study. That is breakpoint.org/SW study.
When you donate through our special link, you will also receive the opportunity to join us for a special Abolition of Man book club. You can find more information about the book club on our Strong Woman Facebook page. And to persuade you that this study will be something you will not want to miss, we will leave you with this quote from Abolition of Man. We make men without chests and expect from them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst.
We look forward to discussing this book with you. Welcome to the Strong Women Podcast, where we explore a deeper understanding of the humanity, value, intellect, and creativity of women. I'm your host, Sarah Stonestreet.
And I'm your co-host, Erin Kunkel.
Our guest today on the Strong Women Podcast is our friend Maria Bear, who is an experienced reporter, writer, and podcaster. For those of you who listen to Breakpoint, Maria is one of the writers for these commentaries, and she is also the host, co-host with my husband, John Stonestreet, for Breakpoint this week, which is so fun to listen to you guys. I love that you can give it right back to John. Like, some people get intimidated by his sarcasm, and you're like, I got this. So I love
that. That's kind of my way of dealing with my feelings of intimidation as I overcompensate by being
right?
sarcastic. Yeah.
Yeah. Just to be super sarcastic back. If you do listen to Breakpoint, you'll recognize her name. If you don't, I mean, you totally should,
please,
right?
Come on, Maria? It's the best.
Yeah. She's published regularly in Christianity Today, the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, World Magazine, the Gospel Coalition, and, you know, a plethora of other places. She and her husband have 2 little girls and live in Columbus, Ohio. Well, thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
And before we jump in, I just want to say, because Maria gets to voice her opinion about things, and one is surrogacy, so I just wanted to give everybody a heads up. That's the direction we're going with Maria after, of course, we hear her story.
Yes, so Maria, we always like to talk about the person we're talking to. So actually, my first question for you is about your name. I know many Marias, and I'm just curious, is Maria a family name, or how did you get your beautiful name?
Oh, thank you. I love that question. So it's actually an interesting story. So I have 2 siblings, and they both have names that start with J. And my dad's name starts with J as well. So he's Joseph, and then I have Jennifer and a brother named Joey. And I was supposed to be Jessica. They were going to keep with the J's. But my family is Catholic, and I was born on December 12th. So for all of the Hispanic Catholic listeners to Strong Women, December 12th is a feast day of Our Lady of Guadalupe. So that's a feast day of Mary that's celebrated primarily in Mexico. And my aunt, who was always well-read on all of her saints and feast days, told my mom, this is my mom's older sister, you have to name her Maria. You know, obviously in Mexico, Mary is referred to as Maria. And my mom was like, that's not a J name, but she went with it anyway because I was born fairly early, I think 5 weeks early, which in, you know, the mid 80s was a long time. And so it was a little scary for my mom. And so that was meaningful to her, I think, too, to name me after Mary. So that's how I'm named Maria.
Wow. I'm glad you asked that, Erin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I figured there might be a story there, and I just have had so many friends growing up with the name Maria, and I love the name. Cool. So thanks for explaining that. Yeah. And I just found out you were born in the 80s, so now I definitely know I'm older than you. I already knew I was, but Now I'm like, okay, I'm older than her. Okay, so Maria, you mentioned your siblings, your parents. Mm-hmm. Where did you grow up? And so were you guys a practicing Catholic family? Like you went to church every Sunday? Okay, so tell us about growing up.
Yeah, so I live in Columbus, Ohio right now. I grew up outside of Canton, Ohio, so a little northeastern of here, but kind of a small town. And yes, we were a practicing Catholic family, so went to Mass every Sunday. I was baptized into the Catholic Church, had my first communion, my first confession, and I was confirmed when I was in eighth grade. I went to Catholic elementary school. I ended up transferring to the public school in middle school just because the Catholic school was getting smaller and smaller in my town. But so definitely a devotedly Catholic family. And you know, my parents both, you know, very faithful people. And so is my younger brother still. And when I was in high school, a friend invited me to her church that was Protestant. And I went to it and loved it and started kind of reading the Bible with her. And this was sort of my experience of Catholicism, even though we were very serious about it, and I knew about Jesus, and my parents were like wonderful teachers of the Bible and that sort of thing. Reading the Bible on your own is not, there's not as much of a premium placed on that, I think, in a lot of Catholic families as there is in Protestant families or churches. So I had never really sat down and read it on my own. I heard it in school and in church, but in high school, I started really reading it on my own and had a lot of questions about the Bible itself, but also about Catholicism, and started meeting with my priest, who was like a close friend of my family's, and he was wonderful and like a great discipler. But ultimately, when I was like probably a junior in high school, decided I really didn't think I wanted to be Catholic anymore. I want to be careful how I say this, because I still think Catholicism is beautiful and that many, many Catholics are faithful, wonderful followers of Jesus, like my family. But I didn't want to go to Mass anymore. And my parents, in a super wise and sweet way, were like, okay, that's fine. But, you know, as long as you live here in our house, you have to go to Mass. So if you want to go to a different church too, you can do both, but you'll just have to do it outside of Mass. Mm-hmm. So for the rest of high school, I did that. I went to Mass and my friend's church, which then I considered to be my church as well. And then in college, just kind of stopped going to Mass altogether. So I still go when I'm back with my parents, and I still think it's beautiful. And the Catholic Church is where I met Jesus, for sure. But that's kind of my faith background. So,
mm-hmm. That must have been hard for your parents, but I actually appreciate that. They said, well, while you're here, though, this is what we do as a family. So you're going to do it too.
They made it clear that they, you know, I think my mom said one day, like, as long as you love Jesus, you know, like that's what's most important. And there was a little bit of, I think they were maybe a little disappointed, you know, when I got married, we couldn't get married in the Catholic Church, in part because I think I wasn't going regularly, but also Aaron, my husband, is not Catholic. So I think they were a little disappointed, understandably. I'm sure they had pictured that, you know, since I was born. But they've never been disappointed about, you know, my faith. I think they know that I have a relationship with Jesus, and they've always been clear that that's what's most important.
So journalism and writing has kind of been the path that you've taken that's led you to where you are right now. But when did that start? Like, have you always enjoyed stories? And when did it kind of make sense to you that you wanted to study journalism?
Sure. I think from when I was young. So my family was very involved with Focus on the Family. Mm-hmm. My mom and dad, I think, read all of Dr. Dobson's books. And I always had a subscription to Brio, which was the teen girls magazine, and obsessively read it, like just absolutely loved it. Like, I would tear out articles that I liked from Brio and sleep with them under my pillow. Like, that's the kind of...
That's a little intense.
It's intense.
Yeah. You were trying to absorb it through the pillow or something?
Right? I don't know. Osmosis or something. No, I just loved good writing, I think. Mm-hmm. And I just always loved reading and everything, too. And I was definitely the weirdo. Like, when I was a kid, Harriet the Spy came out, the movie. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be Harriet the Spy. So in that movie, if you're not familiar, she's like a young girl who lives in a cool city. It's probably Brooklyn or something. And just keeps a notebook where she basically spies on all of her neighbors. And then ends up, I think, like solving a mystery because of all the information she has. So, you know, thinking back on it, it was probably like really intrusive and inappropriate, but I was like, oh man, that is the coolest. And so I totally did that in my neighborhood. I would like keep track of when people, I probably shouldn't even say this publicly, but I
was just going to say, if you're Maria's neighbor right now, I mean, she's acting like this is past tense, but
so I'm not going to, sure. Let's just, I won't share my maiden name. And so people maybe won't know that it was me spying on them. But actually, I probably was really bad at it. And everyone probably knew exactly what I was doing and just didn't care.
Yeah, they're like, 12, oh, that cute girl. She's trying to spy on us again.
I just always, I mean, I've kept a journal since I was 8 and kept it faithfully until I had babies and didn't have time to do that anymore. But just always loved writing. And so by the time it was time to go to school, I decided to go to Ohio University because it's one of the best journalism schools in the country. And I knew that's what I wanted to do. And it was sort of in my neck of the woods. And I got a great scholarship. So it just all kind of seemed to work out. And so that's, you know, from day one, that's what I wanted to do. And it always, you know, stuck to it, I guess.
So how did you break into the world of journalism for Christian publications?
Sure.
Like World Magazine, which I love, Christianity Today, all the things that you write for.
Yeah. So I was in the magazine track of journalism at OU. It's very specialized. And every magazine journalism student had to have an internship at a publication. And I actually got myself an internship at Brio. This was like, best day of my life. I'm going to do this.
Oh, wow.
So Ohio U was a very secular school. And I remember my counselor, who was a great counselor, but, you know, not a believer by any stretch. And I remember when I sent him my application, like, okay, I got this internship at Brio Magazine. It's part of Focus on the Family. This is what I want to be my official internship. He called me into his office and was like, Focus on the are you serious? Like, couldn't believe it. But he was really sweet. And I was like, yes, this is what I want to do. And so he supported that. And so I went to Focus on the Family and did the Focus on the Family Institute, as it was called back then, and worked for Brio in the afternoons. So I had that experience, which was great. Susie Schellenberger, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, and the team that worked there, knew that this wasn't just like a fun thing for me to do in the app, like that I was really studying magazine journalism. So they gave me a lot of really great experiences while I was there. After I graduated, you know, it's journalism is a hard field to break into, harder now even than it was then, but this was like 2009. I was actually working in human resources, and that's another tangent, but it's because I also studied Spanish in school. And after we graduated, my husband and I moved to Phoenix, and every HR department in Phoenix is desperate for someone who speaks Spanish. So even though I had no experience in HR, that was just the first job I could get. But I just started writing a lot of freelance in the afternoons and evenings. I started calling local reporters in Phoenix and begging them to let me take them to lunch and ask them how they got their job and did they like it. And after doing that for a couple years, just through those connections, got random freelance assignments and one thing turned to another. And then in 2014, I got the chance to go to the World Journalism Institute, which is World Magazine's kind of mid-career crash course in how to write for World. I loved World at the time, still do, and that was a huge opportunity. But that experience was kind of how I broke into the world of Christian publications. Mm-hmm. So I've been writing on and off for World since then, and then also, like you mentioned, Gospel Coalition and Christianity Today and all of that.
I love that story about you seeking out people who were older than you, who had gotten into it, and asking them for advice, because I know we have a lot of young listeners to our podcast. And, you know, a lot of times we look at people who are doing things that maybe we want to do. Maybe someone listening is like, I want to be a writer. And just how we can go about doing that is learning from people who are doing it. And I just like, I mean, it says something about you that you were just, you kept striving towards, I want to do this thing. I want to get better. I want to. So how do I get better? So I think that you already gave great advice just through your story.
Well, don't be too complimentary. I think it says something more about my husband, because I was really shy about it and intimidated to do that. And he was the one that was like, you know, some tough love. And I remember him telling me too, nobody's going to say no to like getting to share about their job to like a younger person. Everyone is flattered by that kind of thing. And he was right. But people were always just super happy and friendly to like, just tell me about what you do and how did you, it was, yeah, that was a great experience. It was a lot of fun.
Well, props to hubby then, because we need people like that in our lives too, that just say, keep trying.
Yeah, you can do this. Okay, so one last question about your career journey that I'd like to know is, how did you get from those things that you were doing with, you know, writing to work for Breakpoint?
Gosh, that's a good question. So, you know what, Sarah? I want to ask John that and then just see what he would I have loved and read John's work for years, especially there's some crossover there with World. So I had done some reporting with The World and Everything in It, which is World Magazine's daily news podcast. And John, most Fridays, does a segment with them called Culture Friday, where he talks about the news of the week. I had loved that for years. We were back in Ohio, and I'd been writing for Christianity Today and the Gospel Coalition and World for a while. And then actually, my husband's organization, so Aaron runs a family policy council here in Ohio. So it's basically a public policy organization that advocates for Christ-centered public policy. And he was having a fundraising dinner and asked John and Jim Daly from Focus on the Family to come and speak at this fundraising dinner. And I ended up sitting with John and Jim Daly at dinner. And we had a really great conversation. I think it was shortly after President Trump was elected. So politics was obviously on everybody's mind. And we had a really great conversation. And I think around that time, the Breakpoint team were looking for some additional writers. And so it was a couple months after that, I think, that John called me and was like, hey, what about if you wrote some stuff for us? So,
oh, cool. So it's being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Okay, we're going to just jump in and we're going to begin with surrogacy. Now, I had a conversation with a friend a couple months ago, and I realized, you know, when I was talking about surrogacy, she hadn't even thought about the implications of it or kind of the ethics of it. Sure. And she was kind of like, huh, I've never really thought about this, which sparked my imagination because I had heard you talk about it, and I know you've done a lot of research about that. And I thought this would be a good conversation to wrestle with for our audience and for ourselves. Sure. So anyway, maybe we should start by defining what we're talking about when we talk about surrogacy. Can you define that?
Yeah. Surrogacy, there are two different ways of going about doing it. There is private surrogacy and commercialized surrogacy, which have some different ethical questions, but share a lot of the same ethical concerns as well. Essentially, because of the technology that we have now when it comes to reproduction, we're able to take an egg and a sperm from a woman and a man and create an embryo outside of the body and then implant that embryo into usually a third party, so a surrogate mom. So then essentially this is where a woman is carrying a child for two other people. So a woman is carrying a child that she's not genetically related to. And then usually in the commercialized surrogacy world, it's a financial transaction. So women are hired to do that for couples who either can't have children of their own, or they're a lot of times homosexual couples who, for obvious reasons, can't create children of their own. And then in the private surrogacy world, it's the same pattern. It's a woman who's not genetically related to an embryo, but the embryo is implanted and she carries and has the child. But sometimes it's done for family members or, you know, outside of a commercial transaction. But surrogacy itself is a woman carrying an embryo for another couple or another person. So then after giving birth, she's not the mom.
Okay, so Maria, are both forms of surrogacy legal in America?
So in some places they are. In most states, gestational surrogacy, which is not commercialized, it still usually involves a lawyer and sometimes money changes hands. that is legal in a lot more places than commercial surrogacy. There are some states like New York that have recently moved to legalize commercial surrogacy, which is typically where you'd go through an agency and, you know, the couple might not even know the woman who carries their baby. That is only legal in a few places, but there are a lot of cities and states that are seem to be moving in the direction of legalizing it, but that's only a handful of places right now.
I think Colorado does because
really,
I was just looking around in preparation for this conversation, and there's like CCRM Colorado, and they have becoming a gestational carrier is an act of personal generosity, and then it even gives a money sum and all that. So I wonder.
Okay.
Colorado must be. I mean, I'm surprised California. They're probably on that track too.
California, it is legal in California, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So for our audience, can you talk to us about, for someone who's never thought about it, and when they probably, you know, most of us aren't really aware of this whole commercial world that you're talking about.
Sure, yeah.
And we're going to link to some of the articles that you've written in our show notes. So for people listening, we hope you'll go to those articles Maria's written. A recent one about surrogacy in Kenya, and that's a commercial enterprise that's going on. But so can you talk to us about, okay, what are the ethical issues that we should think about when it comes to this issue of surrogacy?
Sure. The first one that, because I think I was like you, Sarah, where I just hadn't really thought about this a lot. Until it was like a year and a half or so ago that we did a Breakpoint commentary about surrogacy because Anderson Cooper, the CNN anchor, announced that he and his husband had a baby through surrogacy. And so we were kind of talking about it as a team. And this was the first kind of ethical issue that really sprang up to me was something feels exploitative about that. So this was a wealthy homosexual couple that paid a woman to have their baby. And even from a, you know, if I were to take off my Christian worldview hat, even from, I was thinking like a progressive or liberal point of view, you would think there would be some opposition to that even right there, because you could see how that could so easily lead to exploitation. And that's, I think, what we have seen in the US, but certainly in other countries where commercial surrogacy in a lot of foreign countries is a lot of bigger of an industry than here, but it's a lot of Western couples that will go to foreign countries because it's so much cheaper there, and then pay women who are very, very poor to have babies. And I mean, it's so obvious the ethical issues that could arise with something like that. And there have been a lot of reports of women having baby after baby after baby to a point that's not healthy and not safe for their body. In countries especially that are impoverished, there's also reports of women being hired and then having babies that end up having a birth defect or have special needs. And then the parents who paid this woman to carry the child then say, I don't want to take that baby home. And then the parents leave. And that's a whole subset of really horrible ethical issues that are created there. So the exploitation, both of women and babies, was kind of the main issue that I was thinking of when we first started covering this, when I first started writing about it, I should say, at Breakpoint. And then the more I looked into it and really wrestled with it with John and the team, and actually after that first commentary we did about the situation with Anderson Cooper and kind of exploring some of the exploitation, I found out just on a personal level that someone in my church had been a surrogate multiple times. And she was very respectful, and I hope that she felt that I was too. But we had a good conversation about it, and I ended up having some other great conversations with other women in my church about it. But that kind of opened my eyes to the reality that Christians, like really Bible-believing, strong Christians, think really differently about this, or haven't thought about it very much in terms of the other ethical concerns as believers. And that was kind of when I read, I remember John telling me, you need to read Our Bodies Tell God's Story by Christopher West, which is a really cool kind of layman's translation of Pope John Paul II's Theology of the Body, which when I read it, I called my mom and was like, Mom, I'm reading something by the Pope. you know, by Pope John Paul. I'm very excited.
Yes. Aren't you proud of me, Mom?
She was very proud. And
we had Christopher on the podcast, and it was so good.
It was so great. Yeah. And so I'm sure a lot of these issues you guys probably talked about with him too. But, you know, another issue that really made me feel more and more strongly that we need to talk about surrogacy and really the inherent problems with it is, I think, you know, you are both moms, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are moms as well. And something about me could not handle the image of giving birth to a baby and handing the baby over. Something just feels really upsetting and disturbing about that. And now I want to be careful to say that there is brokenness in the world, and there are extremely heroic and selfless moms who know that they can't parent and have given over children for adoption. And so I don't mean to say that this is always an evil thing to do. But when you've created the issue on purpose, like you've gone into getting pregnant with the knowledge that you will take that child away from the body that carried it, I can't be convinced that that is within the bounds of procreation the way God made it. The only thing that baby knows when it's born is the body that it just lived in for 9 months. The baby doesn't know its genes, you know, it doesn't know who paid for it, which sounds crass, but is for real what happens. The baby knows that body, and that is cruel in my estimation to take a baby from the body that it knows. I also feel that it's cruel for the women. You know, it's cruel to take a baby from the women. And, you know, Jennifer Lahl, who I've interviewed a couple times for different stories, she runs the Center for Bioethics and Culture. And she's done a lot of work in the area of surrogacy. And she's interviewed countless women who have been hired to be surrogates and then had a real emotional problem with handing over the baby after the birth. You know, some women have not had that issue that have been surrogates. And, you know, I've interviewed women who have not felt that way at all. So I don't mean to paint a picture that everybody does. But I think our gut reaction to that severing of that relationship is indicative of what's really happening there, which is we're taking something that was designed by God within a certain boundary, which is having children is meant to be done between two people who are committed to raising the child together in a committed relationship and supportive environment, in as much as they can control that. And we've taken that and separated it like into disparate parts. So there's a baby, there's a man, there's a woman, maybe there's another man, maybe there's another woman, there's money involved. We've separated it in a really bad way. I feel like I should be able to think of a better word for bad, but just in a way that it's not supposed to be separated. And what's going to naturally result from that is going to be bad consequences for the people involved, especially for the most vulnerable people, which are going to be the child and the mom.
Okay. Well, back to the Christopher West connection. On our podcast, he said, you know, the definition of death is the body and soul separating. And so when we try to say that our bodies don't matter, that is a form of death.
Sure.
Sorry, I'm trying to make this connection, but there's kind of this understanding of the body that's not as whole when you think of, you know, it's almost like renting your body out in a way. Okay, did any of that connection, do you see where I'm going with that?
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think I completely agree with what you're saying, which is something about the process of surrogacy is there's an implicit acknowledgement or an assertion that the body is not important, that it's not important that that baby was in that body, right? That that body can just be replaced by the one who paid for it or the one who wants it or whatever. And, you know, I want to say, like, it is possible, and I know it's possible because I've seen it happen. It's possible for everyone in a surrogacy situation to have really good intentions, you know, for a surrogate, a woman who acts as a surrogate to really just want to bless a family and to not be in it for money or whatever, or even women who do it for money who are just trying to provide for their family, you know, if they're very impoverished and they're not able to find other kinds of work or whatever it is. And it's possible that, you know, a couple wants to have children desperately and they can't, you know, that I don't mean to suggest that in every surrogacy situation, you know, there's somebody like twirling a wax mustache in the back room, like having really malicious intent. But the intent does not change the fact of what's happening, you know, like the facts on the ground, that you're creating a baby in a body and then taking it away from that body, you know. And also, I think the other ethical concern from a Christian perspective is that there's something, this is hard to talk about again, because having children is such an emotional, understandably, situation for everybody. But there's a certain assertion here too, that like we have a right to children, and we have a right to children with our DNA. You know, when couples are hiring a third party to have a child for them, they're saying no to adoption, which is not a possibility for everybody, financially or otherwise. So I don't mean to say like, why don't you just go next door and adopt? I know that that's not easy. But they're essentially saying, I feel that I deserve a child enough that has my own DNA, that I'm going to go around God's boundaries and around God's design for family and procreation to get it. I just don't think we have that freedom as much as we might want to, you know? And I think that that sort of worldview around children, we're seeing played out in other areas. We don't need to get into all the other areas, but we treat children like objects in a lot of ways in our current culture. This is one of them. And that's never okay. And it's never biblical. You know, as parents, we know children are not something that decorate our lives. They're not clay that we can mold into being whatever we would like them to be. Naomi, my five-year-old just started violin lessons, and I've already confessed to everyone in my life, it is 100% because I really want to know how to play the violin, and I'm like, my kid's going to take violin lessons. But I also think it's going to be good for her, and she wants to do it. But I mean, we have an impulse to, you know, mold our children in a way that we'd like, but we are to view our job as parents in that we've been entrusted. You know, these children have been entrusted to us for a time, but they are God's first and foremost. He made them and they're his. And so there's something about surrogacy that involves saying, I want this, so I'm going to figure out a way to get it. I just don't think we have that freedom.
Okay, I want to push back on this idea just to help wrestle through it, because I can imagine people listening, and I know people who are listening who have been involved in surrogacy. Mm-hmm. And so first, the distinction between the commercial, hiring, paying, money exchange, and probably the women that you talk to in your church, who it's a personal thing where they sacrificed themselves to help gift a couple with. And I know that's what you're saying, but I just want to do make that distinction that there are different kinds, and the commercial kind, the Anderson Cooper, what we're talking, you know, the what's going on in Kenya and other countries of just this hiring of women to so that they can use their bodies to produce these children that a same-sex couple cannot produce, right, or, you know, for whatever reason they're hiring. So you mentioned that surrogacy goes around God's design. So here's what I want to wrestle with and let our audience wrestle with this too. So what would you say to the person who says, listen, this is just using the advances we've made in medicine, just like we use in all kinds of areas. It's just using this advancement in medicine that God certainly uses. He uses drugs, you know, to heal diseases and, you know, all of these sorts of things. So what makes this, in your mind, Maria, and in your argument, not just in your mind, but what's the argument that this is actually going around God's design in a different way? Because I think that's what you're saying. But but how so? How so?
I think the crux, like the short answer to that is that this involves a person's life, like a human life, as opposed to fighting an ailment or something like that.
So the baby you're talking about.
Yes. Yeah, this involves creating or using those advancements to create a baby. And I think what's been really helpful to me as I've thought about this, because you're right, I have spoken to women and families who have truly and honestly done this as a way of self-sacrificing for people that were just in utter despair over not being able to have children of their own. And, you know, I think that the motives there are a beautiful picture of generosity. I mean, I don't know about you both, but I really was very uncomfortable during my pregnancies. Like, I did not enjoy being pregnant. So the idea of someone doing that for someone else, I understand the generous spirit that that would take. Mm-hmm. But again, this involves a person. So what's been helpful for me is to think about this, and I've talked to Katie Faust, who I know you all have had on Strong Women as well, about this, is to frame it in terms of children's rights. If you really think about this from the terms of the right of that baby, that's where I get tripped up, because I want to be sensitive in how I say this, and I think this is going to sound harsh, especially for people who are going through maybe infertility. But I do think it's important to say, a couple does not have a right to a baby more than a baby has a right to his or her mother. And when you take a baby from the woman who carried that baby, that is a violation of rights that, again, we don't have the freedom or like the biblical sign off to do, I think. And there's going to be pain involved in that for everybody. It's incredibly painful to tell a couple or a woman that she can't have children of her own. But again, that just doesn't justify we can't violate the rights of children to their parents. And that's, I think, that speaks to God's design. You know, God's design for allowing men and women to create children together, you know, that the fact that it takes a man and a woman to create a child, and ordaining the fact of marriage into the design of human beings, that's not an arbitrary, like, well, that's just the way he chose to do it. That's going to be the best situation. And he knew that for children. I mean, we see this playing out even in like all of the social science data that we have. The kids who tend to be the healthiest emotionally, spiritually, oftentimes physically, who do the best in school, who, you know, feel the safest, are kids that grow up with a committed mom and dad in the same family. And, you know, that's not always possible. Parents pass away, unfaithfulness happens, divorces happen. God can and does redeem people's stories where there's brokenness involved. But when he designed it so that the two people who create the child are the one that care for it, it's because that's what's best for us and for that child. And when we walk into surrogacy, so a child hasn't even been conceived yet, and we say, we're going to do this on purpose, knowing ahead of time we're going to sever this relationship that God meant for us not to sever, I don't think that's okay. And that's not going to be best for the child or the mom or the woman who carries the child. It's just not going to be best.
Yeah. You mentioned Katie Faust, and that's another resource we could point people to. She wrote the book Them Before Us, and she has a whole section on surrogacy. And what you're talking about, as I could just feel people wrestling with, mm-hmm. is, you know, you're saying separating from the mother and father. So they would say, well, no, you're... It's the mother's egg, the father's sperm, let's say, in a scenario. Because there's so many different scenarios in this.
Right, totally.
But Katie talks about, and this is something I hadn't considered before reading her stuff, was just what does happen in the womb with the connection of the baby to the mom, and how much they do, you know, recognize and look for the mom after birth, you know, that sort of thing. And so this is, I think, you know, the reason we wanted to talk about it is because of the medical advancements in our culture. You know, this is not something that we had to talk about 50 years ago.
Right.
So these are newer conversations. And so as Christians, we want to be clear thinkers on this issue, especially like you mentioned, it is different than medicine in that we are talking about human life. And we do want to bring our Christian worldview of how God designed human life to flourish. And the way he's designed human life to flourish is that, yes, a child is born with a mother and a father, and they get to stay with that mother and father. And then, of course, we never stop that story and say that's it, because God provided a way to be redeemed because sin messed up that whole design, right? And my own story is a part of that, of being a single mom and, you know, not having the God's ideal for my daughter and myself, but that he can redeem these situations. Surrogacy oftentimes, like you said, is gone into where we purposely are saying we will create this child in a womb of a woman that that child won't stay connected to. And that's really the issue that we want people to consider and think about before we just blindly endorse, especially any kind of surrogacy.
Some of the pushback we got when we first started talking about it around Anderson Cooper was a lot of people feel that ethically surrogacy is similar to or the same as adoption. And our response to that was kind of what you just said, where adoption repairs brokenness that we all acknowledge has occurred. It's never the ideal that a child is not with their parents, but sometimes it has to happen. We live in a fallen world, and adoption is a way of God redeeming a lot of times that brokenness. Surrogacy starts from a place of not brokenness. I mean, it can start with infertility, which is for sure a form of brokenness. But what I mean is surrogacy first creates the problem and then tries to fix it. And that's the main ethical difference, is that we shouldn't be creating that problem in the first place.
Yeah, I think I'll just mention, I mean, I know one woman in my life who's a dear Christian woman who was a surrogate mom, the problem was created in that there were embryos of a family member and the family member couldn't carry those embryos in her body anymore. And so she stepped in for one of those embryos that was already there in the refrigerator. I don't know how they keep it.
That's super complicated.
It is.
It's like it's kind of adoption because the problem is created. Right? The embryos are life. And then what do you do? Oh, whoa, that's
really... Which is why these issues are intertwined. You know, again, are so important for us to think about. Because then if it... Yeah. Then it leads to, do we create these embryos? And so anyway, what did
I
you
would,
want to
in
say?
In that situation, I actually would, I think, consider like an ethical adoption. You know, there's a lot of snowflake adoptions, which are adopting embryos. Mm-hmm. The difference is if they, you know, went into creating those embryos knowing that they couldn't be carried by their mom, or that, you know, I guess the difference is the intention on the other side of it beforehand. But I've also known women who have adopted and carried embryos. Yeah. And I think that's another form of redeeming a brokenness, you know?
Yeah.
Well, as you can tell, this issue is complicated, and it's so good that we were able to wrestle with this some, but I know it probably brought up a lot more questions than we could answer, but you know, that was actually our goal. We can't answer all the questions in this one podcast, but we just would encourage all our listeners to go find some people to talk about this with and wrestle with it, and read some books. And we'll link to some, like Katie's book, Them Before Us. We'll link to some articles. And Maria, do you have any recommendations on...
I would also just check out Jennifer Lahl's work at the Center for Bioethics.
Okay.
She has some short documentaries as well on her site just about surrogacy that have been really helpful as well.
Oh, good. I want to look into that, too. I've not heard her name. Mm-hmm. Okay, we need to go to our ending questions. What advice would you give for young women today? We've got a lot of young listeners, so what do you think?
Yeah. So I've been thinking about this question because I knew you guys were going to ask me it. And I want to hedge at first and just say that the advice that I will give is probably advice I would give to my younger self. I don't know that I feel qualified giving like blanket advice to all young women, because all young people are so different.
That's fair.
But I think the first thing that I wish I could have told my younger self is that you're like, especially wanting to be a writer, I want to put this delicately, but I wouldn't have been as delicate with my younger self. But like, you don't have to try and save the world. Like, every thought that you have that feels new to you is not new, probably. Most people have thought it before. I went for several years thinking I was like incredibly brilliant and the world needed to hear my story, as they say. And that's a lot of pressure. And also, it's really surprising when then you send drafts to Brio and they're like, thanks, but no thanks. And you're like, but it's me, though.
Yeah. It's like, ouch, I thought I had a thought there, but nope.
That was a hard learning curve, but like so much freedom in realizing that God has called you to be faithful in the tiny little impact that he's given you to make. And that is... there is so much freedom in living in that rather than thinking like you're responsible for, you know, saving the world. Or I always thought that being a mom and a wife was a small thing, you know, like I have the most incredible mom that's ever mommed. And I still remember thinking of her like, oh, she has such a sweet and simple life and I'm going to have a much bigger one. And now realizing that that is the biggest and most intense and God-honoring impact I think you can make when you're called to do that. So for people, women who are called to be wives and moms, like that's big enough is, you know, what I would have said to my younger self. Mm-hmm. And being a mom for me and a wife, because I've, in particular, Maria has been called to do that, will far and away be my most favorite thing that I've ever gotten to do. And I think the most impactful and important and the hardest, and the opportunity to be the most faithful in my life are in those callings. And it's kind of a reversal of the way I thought about it as a kid, but that's not true.
I think that's good advice. I think it's good, actually, what you did to think about your younger self. It's too overwhelming to think, like, what would I say to every young girl? But yeah, what would I say to my younger self is, I think, a good way to think
about
it.
Yeah, I mean, not every young girl will grow up to be a wife and a mom, and that doesn't I don't want to give advice that says grow up and be a wife and a mom. I guess my advice would be don't shortchange what that calling is.
Okay, we love to talk about books on the podcast. So, Maria, what books are you reading right now?
Oh, my gosh. I've been so excited for you to ask me this, but also nervous to answer it because I love good essays, like long form, personal, but also kind of reporting essays. That's the kind of writing that's like my dream to be able to do. And I don't do it very well. And so I'm kind of on a kick of just reading a lot of essay collections right now because I want to get better at it. And so I'm reading an essay collection by David Foster Wallace called Consider the Lobster. He's a very edgy writer. He is deceased now and had a really challenging life and a lot of mental health issues. And I think that he might have considered himself a believer at different parts of his life, but his essays are certainly not safe for work, as they say. So there's a lot of explicit content and that sort of thing. But he really sees the world in an incredibly unique way. And I actually just read one of the essays I just finished today. I'm going to send to John because he has to read it. He's going to love it. And it's about how he was actually hired by a magazine in like the late 90s to write a review of a dictionary, like a usage dictionary that was being published. And the whole essay is about how dictionaries are full of worldview. Like what words are included and how they're defined is completely dependent on who wrote it and where they're coming from. And so it's just a brilliant, I mean, it's way too long. Everything he writes is way too long. But
John is totally going to nerd out about that.
Oh, right. And I mean, I think I called my husband like four different times during the day and was reading him portions of it. He got really sick of it. So I'm reading that, but I'm also making my way through some classic books. This started when the pandemic started. I decided I was going to read some books that I felt like I should have read in college. Part of the problem with a journalism major was that I took almost no English classes. I think I only took one. So all of my writing and everything was towards reporting and journalism. So I feel like I missed out.
Wow.
So I finished Wuthering Heights recently, which I've been so surprised by how dark and edgy some of these classic books are, but just brilliant and fun to read, but also giving me scary dreams. So I finished that one recently. I think I'm going to tackle some Jane Austen next. So I'm excited about that.
It's much, much less dark.
A little lighter. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Last question.
Yes.
Is if you could have coffee with any woman from history, who would it be?
Right. Okay. I was excited for this question too. Okay. I have two short answers. Short-ish.
It's okay. You can have two.
My first one is Corrie ten Boom. Yes. I read her book, The Hiding Place, I think just like a year ago. It was recent. Obviously, her story is incredible. So her family had a little hiding spot in their house in Holland and allowed Jewish families to live there during the Holocaust. And she and her sister were eventually taken to a concentration camp. And I think the biggest question I have for her after reading that book is, obviously, it's an incredible story, but she has one of those dispositions that I just find unbelievable. Like, and I don't understand having a disposition like hers, especially after the story that she lived through. And I just want to ask her about that. Like, you meet or read about people like her, and I think that person was an angel or had some sort of, like, you know, they had the Holy Spirit, and I just want to know what it's like to be her. She treated every interaction she had, both in that book and then in interviews I've read with her later, with such generosity that it seems unreasonable. And I just want to know what that's like, and if that's attainable for a cynical person like me. I kind of want her to tell me, no, it's not attainable. Don't worry. You can be cynical.
But you're excused. I have a feeling
that, right? You're excused from being generous. But I just find her fascinating, just her whole character. But the other person I thought of was any of the other wives of Jacob, as in Jacob, the father of, you know, Jacob at Israel, the father of the 12 tribes, because any of the other wives, I mean, aside from Rachel. So I read a fiction book called The Red Tent several years ago, and it was like a fictionalized account of that story. And just made me reflect on, you know, Jacob was so obvious about Rachel is my favorite wife. And what was it like for his other wives who gave birth to other sons and who seemed to be really strong women in their own right and obviously raised the sons of Israel, so a huge impact on the life of God's people, but operated within a system that we would view as like really unfair and unfortunate, but still did it with grace. And yeah, I wonder what their personalities were like and if they were okay with it.
Yeah, that is interesting. And
yeah, that book really sparked my fascination with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah. The other wives. Those are my other
wives. We have not had that one yet.
I know. And I think Leah, his other wife, you know, yeah. Rachel was his favorite, yet he ends up being buried with Leah.
Right.
And the Savior comes through Leah's.
Through Leah, right?
Line. And a beautiful part in the Jesus Storybook Bible. I don't know if you guys have read that to your kids, yeah. But the story of Leah in that, and she talks about how Leah is seen by God, and he sees her because, of course, her father just kind of gave her to Jacob, and Jacob didn't really want her, but God saw her. And then the Savior comes through her line. It's
that
just
beautiful.
It's beautiful
that
to think incredible. About. So you, I love that answer. That. Yeah. I love that answer. And I want to sit with you and talk to them.
Right?
So,
yeah. I know. I want to talk
about this
more.
So let's plan to do that.
I think what I love about them too is that there are women in the biblical story and elsewhere that I greatly admire who like rose up against adverse circumstances and should have and were clearly called to. For whatever reason, they weren't called to do that. And so they just lived in that scenario, but still, like you said, were seen and used by God. And I, you know, if I'm ever called to do something like that, I want to do it like they did it, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, Maria, it's been so great just sitting down and talking with you. Thanks for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me, you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Strong Women Podcast, powered by the Colson Center. To connect with Sarah, Erin, and other amazing women, join our Strong Women Podcast Facebook group and check us out on Instagram at StrongWomenCC. If the Strong Women Podcast has been an encouragement to you, consider leaving a podcast review on iTunes or making a gift at strongwomen.colsoncenter.org. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next week.